This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we look at the Boeing Maneuvering Characteristics Augmentation System, or MCAS, for the 737 MAX, the Lockheed Martin X-59 Quiet Supersonic Technology Aircraft, and Aurora Flight Sciences High-Altitude Pseudo-Satellite, Japan Airlines Pilots and Drinking, and the TSA's Automated Security Lanes. Also, Launchpad Marzari reports on the Red Bull Air Race World Championship Finale in Fort Worth. It's all coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 528 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me is first Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He was the 2008 CFI of the year. He's also an expert on the Cirrus aircraft. Max T, back from Australia.
I am back. So good to be here. I enjoyed listening to the show a few days ago. And I was just trying to figure out here. So I was down under. What's the opposite now that I'm home? Is that up above?
Up above. You're up above. Well, what do they say down there?
It doesn't have the same ring at all. I have no idea. I forgot to ask that.
It doesn't. That'd be the question. Okay. Also with us is our aviation historian, David Vanderhoof. Hi, David.
Do you know how many listeners now, especially McCarran, is going to jump on that conversation?
I hope so, yeah.
Hi, all. Happy early, when this comes out, it'll be the day before Thanksgiving, and I hope everyone will have a happy, in the States here, have a happy holiday with their family and friends and food and football, and the rest of the world, we wish you the best on this, probably my favorite holiday of the year.
Very good. Also with us this episode is our Airplane Geeks reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari. How you doing, guy?
I'm doing well. Hello from deep in the heart of. Just having a great aviation weekend and ready to continue on.
All right. Launchpad attended the Red Bull Air Race, and we're going to hear some more about that coming up. We're going to go without a guest one more week. It makes things easier, shorter, faster, quicker for the post-production part of this cycle. And we need the time lately to attend to other affairs. But we're going to restart guests next week, and I'm really looking forward to that. You know, guys, it doesn't feel the same without guests. It feels like only half a show to me. I don't know what you guys think, but I'm looking forward to bringing guests back.
It's like having a house party or a dinner party and only, you know, the neighbor shows up and none of the other guests do.
Yeah, it kind of does.
Hey, we should mention to people, Max, you're sounding deeper and throatier today. Why is that?
Health, I guess. I think I'm coming down with something. But, yeah, I feel in my head like it's a different kind of a voice than usual. But
He's just moody this week.
Well, that could be, but... All right, well, let's jump right into the news, some of the aviation news from the past week. Are you guys ready?
Ready from the West.
Ready deep in the heart of.
Ready.
We'll start off with a story from AvWeb. This is FAA probes potential 737 MAX design flaw. Well, as I think probably most of you know, the FAA is focusing on the automated stabilizer trim system that Boeing added to the 737 MAX aircraft. This is called the Maneuvering Characteristics Augmentation System, or MCAS, I guess. And the FAA may end up requiring Boeing to design a fix for this system. And as we've seen in other reports, apparently this system really... Well, it wasn't well documented, or at least some pilots and some airlines were unaware that this change has been made. So that's the direction this is going. This, of course, comes from the Lion Air fatal crash not too long ago. So I'm sure that there are a lot of folks hard at work at Boeing as well as on the NTSB and the FAA trying to nail this down.
This is going to be a big deal because as I understand it, the MCAS works only when you're in the manual flight mode.
Right.
And normally when you're in the manual flight mode, all that automation is not helping you and you're thinking it's off.
Yeah. And in this case, it's not off.
Yeah, and that's kind of counterintuitive. I think pilots are used to either having the system, do unexpected things when it's on autopilot, or when it's off autopilot, you're fully in control. The system's not going to do anything to it. So, yeah, I think it'll probably be pretty unexpected to find the airplane pitching on its own when you're flying manually.
Yeah.
I also understand that there isn't really a circuit breaker that you can pull to turn this thing off.
Ah, so it's not an optional feature, I guess, huh?
It may, the circuit breaker may be tied to other things. It may be, you got to go pull this circuit breaker number, 48, which also turns off, these other two systems. Mm.
Now, David, do you remember the question or the issue that you raised last week when we were talking about the Lion Air crash?
You mean the one that I was right?
That's right. You brought up the idea of...
I called this one, and what was really upsetting about me was... basically broke about 2 hours after we were done recording on last Monday.
Now, you've got to say what it is you're talking about.
Did Boeing screw up and will Boeing be sued? And it sounds like Boeing screwed up and Boeing will be sued. And it sounds like it's going to be a messy situation.
Well, I don't know for sure if Boeing is screwed up yet. I mean, we'll know officially at some point, but the lawsuit has already been filed. It comes from a Florida-based law firm, and they're claiming that this trim system was an unsafe design and that it contributed to the crash. Of course, it's kind of preliminary to conclude that, but that doesn't stop you from filing a lawsuit. It says it is particularly surprising to hear from safety experts and the heads of pilots' unions that Boeing failed to warn its customers and the pilots of the new 737 MAX aircraft about this significant change in the flight control systems. And that's from the suit. And this was filed on behalf of the parents of one of the individuals who was killed in the Lion Air crash.
And I think that's the meat of the argument right there, is that getting your type rating in an aircraft requires you to know pretty much everything that's going on with that aircraft. And to have them put something that's doing something and you don't know about it, and now you're fighting it, Boeing may not have put their best face forward on this one. Hmm.
Well, as the investigation proceeds, we'll have more definitive understanding of just what the sequence of events was, or lack of events along with them that resulted in this crash. I hear that the Indonesian authorities are talking about a preliminary report at the end of November. I think I heard. Which is not too many days away. So we should have at least something soon.
Hey, Max, the other thing that has me curious is how much is this a standalone system like a stick shaker or a stick pusher versus how much is this integrated into the flight systems?
Yeah.
Can they just turn it off, or are they going to have to do a complete reload of all the software on the aircraft to turn this feature off or to modify this feature?
Yeah, interesting. I'm sure Boeing is taking a look at that right now, regardless of the direction this goes. They're probably trying to get ahead of it to the degree they can.
Well, I don't know if you guys caught the related story in Forbes magazine. The title was United Pilots Say They Were Already Trained to Override Boeing 737 MAX Automatic Stall Recovery. So that's going to be interesting as plays out, to find out were some airlines trained, were some not. I think it's so early to really know what really went on, but it's kind of an interesting side angle.
Yeah. All right, from the CNBC, we see Lockheed Martin starts production of its experimental supersonic plane. Now, we've talked about an awful lot of supersonic developments, designs, ideas, the whole spectrum over the past months. And they seem to be creeping closer to something that actually flies. But this is from Lockheed. Last year, NASA awarded them, Lockheed, a contract, an almost $250 million contract, to develop an aircraft that could fly at supersonic speed but not create the sonic boom that we're used to when you break the sound barrier, or at least not eliminating it, but at least knocking it down to something that's much more acceptable. So Lockheed's proposal was this X-59 quiet supersonic technology aircraft. And they say that the cruise altitude is designed to be 55,000 feet, reaching speeds of about 940 miles an hour. And according to this CNBC article, it says this new aircraft is expected to create a noise level akin to the sound of a car door closing.
Yeah. No, I guess the question is, how many people slam doors? there are times when I'm in a car and somebody slams the door, and you know, I just jump. So I think there's a wide range of noise from closing a car door.
But still, that won't shatter windows. So this is a pretty small aircraft. I think, David, this is a single seat aircraft, and of course it's a long needle like kind of aircraft. The idea being that you don't get the same type of shockwave coming off the fuselage that results in this double boom kind of sonic boom that we're used to.
We did talk when I was down at NASA Langley a couple years ago. This program was just starting, and they were talking about sonic booms versus sonic thumps. And they originally had an F-5E that had a modified longer nose, kind of a boat-shaped thing to channel the shock of the sonic boom down the fuselage so you're not getting getting that noise going down to the ground. Clearly, I mean, we're not going to eliminate sonic booms, but this is really a minimizing it, and a car door probably is kind of a strange way to think it, but a tolerable thunderclap or something along those lines where it wouldn't be out of the ordinary to someone that it's a sonic boom. So, and this is Quest will be, I mean, they're going to be continuing, so we'll see how well this goes. And it kind of looks like an F-104, to be honest.
Yeah, it kind of does, doesn't it? Yeah.
Which is kind of funny because it just means Clarence Kelly Johnson was well ahead of the game, as much as we know. But it's got a long, pointy nose. And one of those things about long, pointy noses is, have you ever seen what the Concorde did so you could land and take off?
Right.
So this is going to be one of those. We've had aircraft with long, pointy noses before, and they've been tricky to fly. We'll have to ask Mr. Trescott if the next Cirrus that comes out will have a propeller than a long, pointy nose. But I guess he doesn't have to worry about sonic booms, does he?
No, but I'll tell you what to me is most intriguing about the picture of this aircraft. If you look at where the cockpit is, where that one person is, and you kind of roughly measure how much of the airplane is in front of that cockpit and how much is behind that cockpit, it's just about equal. I can't think of any aircraft that's, you know, quite, you know, that's got the, you know, the pilots in the middle of the airplane. I mean, imagine 747 with the pilots in the middle of the airplane.
Well, I mean, that was one of the problems with the Douglas, one of my favorite X-planes, which was a real failure, which was the Douglas X-3 Stiletto, has very similar lines. It's got and really the cockpit is pretty much right over the wing, and there's a lot of nose in front of it. And it had incredibly bad stability problems. Mm. Yeah. So it's interesting that we're going back to, we talk about F-104s and X3s, and we're these kind of technologies that we've talked about. It's kind of like flying wings. We've gone, you know, the flying wing, the B-2 is got the same exact wingspan as the B-40, the original flying wings from Northrop, sure, that Jack Northrop designed. But they couldn't at the time, didn't have the computer technology to stabilize the aircraft. So it was, bingo, a poor bombing platform.
And I think that's the big difference now. So, yeah, they could certainly deal with stability problems in ways that they certainly couldn't 50 years ago.
But it's just what's old is new again, minus the technology. So it'll be interesting to see how the aircraft flies. Besides, now it's got to fly well before they can start dropping booms on. Although, as of last week, NASA has been flying an F-18 over the Gulf to start doing sonic boom testing. So, supersonic transports, you know, they're coming. Whether they're going to be practical or not, it's a dream that people have for a long time. So,
I think this is the ultimate, you know, Uber car, right? It shows up, one person hops in, you go supersonically to your destination. But seriously, how would you scale this thing up? You know, this I don't know how you would put 50 people, you know, in a design like this to scale it up.
Well, it's like the Ariane, which is what we've talked about in the past, is the scaled up version of this. And I mean, it's, I don't know if you're going to get a supersonic jet transport like we had in 69 with Boeing and Lockheed and all of those beautifully fanciful aircraft but Gulfstreams and Cessnas fly awfully close to the speed of sound. It wouldn't be surprising that maybe supersonic transport will be only for the richest of all of us who can own their own supersonic transport.
Or the military. I mean, Lockheed is pretty deep into supersonic here, because not only are they working on this X-59, and as you said, David, working with Ariane on the AS-2, the supersonic business jet, but Lockheed Martin is also developing this SR-72, right? The so-called son of the Blackbird. But that's, I think that's an unmanned airplane, isn't it?
That's okay. That's a whole different. That's a hypersonic aircraft. That's Mach 6 or plus.
Oh, yes.
And it will be. That will be unmanned. The SR-72. The problem with that is then you have to wonder what the mission is. We've worked very hard for hypersonic weaponry that we can intercontinental, not necessarily intercontinental ballistic missiles, but hypersonic weaponry that we can use that are with conventional warheads that we can, the SR-72 is that kind of aircraft. Can you launch and be anywhere over anywhere in an hour and be able to deploy conventional weapons and do a quick strike capability? As far as transports go, Lockheed has worked a lot right now with the stealth transports. The Air Force desperately needs a tactical transport and a tanker that has stealth capabilities, because right now you've got great aircraft like the F-22 and the F-35 that are minimal on radar, but those KC-135s and C-5s and C-17s and KC-10s, they're like flying billboards. So you've got, it's back to when Lockheed did the Sea Shadow, which was a stealth attack ship that they did right around the same time that they did using facets like the F-117. And the problem with the Sea Shadow was the stealth made it glaringly obvious. What happened was the stealth would be was so good, you ended up getting a very large nothing making a very large wake, which sonar would pick up. So what would be out in the ocean making a really large wake but not be there? So that was one of those oh, hadn't thought of that. So that program went away. So, I mean, it's Lockheed is always, the Skunk Works will always be, Lord knows, they're probably four steps ahead of us already. But
no doubt.
But it's an interesting technology, and I've rambled on too long.
So they expect to start flying this X-59 in 2021, late in the year, I think. And reportedly, this is going to be used to collect community response data on the acceptability of the quiet sonic boom generated by the aircraft. So I guess that means they're going to fly it around and and boom the thing and then see what people think about that? Is
the plan is they're going to start in rural areas and then slowly move more closer to metropolitan areas and get people. People actually now can go to NASA, NASA.com and sign up for the F-18 tests.
.gov they want, or .com?
.com. And we'll have a link to the show notes. In the show notes, but you can sign up to, if you're in the Gulf area, to be a civilian scientist, per se, and if you hear the thing go off, you can report it, and so they can get the data. So
it's not NASA.com.
That'd be .gov, most likely.
Yeah, it's got.
But we're missing one of the important things, which is we're going to have a X-plane again flying out of Dryden. I mean Edwards. No, we're going to have it flying out of Armstrong. The first X-plane to be flying out of Armstrong.
Yay. All right. Well, yeah, it's definitely exciting in the land of supersonic and hypersonic. Like you say, this is fun stuff to follow just because, you know, going that fast is cool, right? We like to go fast. Faster is better.
Speaking, this is coming from the F1 Formula One addict.
Yes.
All right. Let's talk about the Boeing Odysseus. This is something that David and I talked about on the last episode of the UAV Digest. This is a high altitude pseudo satellite, they call it, something that has a persistent ability to float around up high in the sky. This is by Aurora Flight Sciences, which, of course, is a unit is owned by Boeing now. This is a high-altitude, long-endurance unmanned aircraft with a pretty healthy wingspan. Max, I don't think we have many other aircraft that you can compare this kind of wingspan to.
Oh, definitely not. This has got to be a new record, if not a record. And just, I think it's kind of interesting that this product is coming out now. If you think back to the beginning of Aurora Flight Sciences, I would imagine that they were started, approximately 30 years ago, maybe a little bit more than that, maybe 32 or 35 years ago. And this is exactly the kind of thing that they started working on way back then. John Langford was a MIT grad at that time who I met in college. And when he first started working on these kinds of things, I remember thinking, wow, this has got to be kind of a limited market. And over the years, Aurora Flight Sciences branched out into, you know, a number of other different things. But it's fascinating that the market is now, you know, really there for this kind of product, where it wasn't really much the case back then. But I just did a quick look here on their website to find out some specs on this thing. So, for example, the payload, you know, the radios and repeaters and other things they could carry aloft, or environmental measuring equipment. They can carry 55 pounds of gear. They've got 250 watts of continuous power available to power that, which, of course, would all come from the solar cells. To your point on wingspan, 243 feet. Now, I looked it up. The Boeing 747, which I just came back on from Australia, 196 feet. So this thing is, you know, about 25% wider than a Boeing 747. The overall weight of the airplane, less than a smart car. And the endurance, they say, many months, nearly infinitely. So the the look of this thing is pretty remarkable. Imagine an incredibly long wing, very thin but extremely long, which is populated completely with solar cells, and then which has three fuselages somewhat evenly spaced out across this. So that gives you about four segments of wing connected with three different fuselages. So remarkable design. Looks like it's going to be flying at very high altitude, and it's going to be a good alternative to satellites for just a tiny fraction of the cost. So I would imagine that the view that it has of the Earth is going to be much smaller than most satellites because it's not as high, but they're so cheap. You could put dozens and dozens of these up for the price of a satellite.
I don't think the market there is so much for what a satellite imagery reconnaissance. I think the monetization of this is going to be satellite radio, satellite comms, a competitor to Iridium, because you could put one of these up over a specific area and double your satellite communications, or have a competitor to Iridium or to XM radio or Cirrus weather. I think that's where it's going to be monetized.
Hmm. Well, they're going to begin flight testing this in Puerto Rico in next year, next spring, April 2019. So that starts up pretty soon. And I think, as Dave and I talked about on the other show, Aurora Flight Sciences isn't really using any exotic technology here. I think in terms of the solar cells and all the rest of it, it's pretty conventional. So there are opportunities to increase the ability, the capability, as the solar cell technology, battery technology improves. But they're going to build, I think, a total of three test aircraft. And what do we say, David? The first one is going to be just solar powered, and then solar electric comes with some of the later, the following two test aircraft.
Yeah, that was correct. Yeah. They got to teach it to fly first before they move on to persistent solar power. The other part about that we talked about on UAV Digest that was we haven't talked about is where you can fly this aircraft.
Hmm.
We talk about testing in Puerto Rico, but one of the confusing show notes last week was we were talking about angle of sunlight, and the higher, the more north or the more south you go, the harder it is. The angle of the sun doesn't give you the ability to get all of the maximum out of the solar panels. So that's why they're starting to fly in Puerto Rico in the tropics.
Right, right. They, I guess they think this is operationally it works at a latitude of about 20 degrees. They expect to be able to get up closer to the 30 degree latitude point, but going beyond that, the efficiency of the solar cells becomes an issue at those latitudes. And so that might require, they say, some different technologies at the higher latitudes. So it's a start, but yeah, that's why it's beginning in Puerto Rico.
And there's one other interesting aspect about this as well, David. You mentioned, they're going to start learning how to fly it. Before that, they've got to start learning how to get it to take off. When you look how wide this thing is, I mean, my rough guesstimate is that the outer wheels are probably on the order of 120 to 150 feet apart. You're going to need a pretty wide runway, and you're also going to want really dead calm conditions, because I would imagine they want to have this thing take off, very early morning, very, very late at night, perhaps. But with all the air currents that you have, especially down around Puerto Rico, they want to get this thing up to altitude very early in the day, as calm as possible. Because to me, it doesn't look like it's really strong structurally.
Hmm.
Well, it's weight. It's we talk about this a lot on UAV Digest about drones and battery weight. And sort of this compromise. And the really big wing is really because it's a really big wing, so you can have lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of solar panels. Because the solar panels, I believe, Max, we talked about, were like 20% efficient.
Yes.
Which really is not a good response. Of all of the energy you're putting into it, you're only getting 20% of it out as usable power for the aircraft to fly. So it'll be interesting.
Yeah, sounds like a lot of opportunity there. Well, last week we talked about, well, the issue of alcohol consumption amongst Japanese pilots. And they have an article or two here, one from Fortune. Anyway, how Japan Airlines plans to solve its drunk pilot program. This says that the JAL co-pilot that we talked about that was arrested at London's Heathrow Airport for being drunk, he actually did take an in-house breathalyzer test, but it sounds like he cheated on the test. I guess the breathalyzer that JAL uses doesn't have a tube, so it was not obvious to, I guess, those around him that he really wasn't blowing into the device. So he was able to, quote, pass the test. Max, is that how you read this?
Yes, and it also says that the chief pilot wasn't watching him, so it sounds like there should have been some supervision. Mm. One of the things that I thought was interesting that's new since the show last week is that Japan Airlines has said that part of the program they're going to put in place to address this problem is to install more breathalyzers at airports that they serve around the world, which was interesting to me. I wasn't aware that airlines installed breathalyzers. Now, the other thing that's kind of interesting is this particular fellow I was arrested in Heathrow, and I think we probably talked about this before. They have a limit which is even lower than we have here in the U.S. So in the U.S., of course, in California, drunk driving would be 0.08. Drunk flying in the United States is 0.04. In the U.K., it's 0.02. So I think it's pretty easy for an airline pilot to have a drink or two the night before and still possibly blow a 0.02 in the morning. But I will say that the large number of incidents they've had, imagine this, 19 incidents since last August. I mean, that's just an incredible number of drunk pilots. That goes well beyond what I would have expected from any airline. So I would have to say it does sound like they have a distinct problem there. It's not just that, gosh, they're getting caught by this low limit in Heathrow. They've got a lot of pilots that are, you know, showing up drunk.
Yeah, that's a surprising number of them for such a short period of time.
Yeah.
Well, JAL says they're going to install, and I guess by now, according to the date that was in this article, JAL should have installed by now new breathalyzers that include the tube that we're all more familiar with, I think. They've also extended their no drinking rule. It had been 12 hours. Now they've changed that or extended it at least provisionally to 24 hours before flying.
That's not the no drinking rule. That's the no fun rule, which is too bad. I mean, I think when pilots are at a, you know, destination long way from home, you know, you're alone. I'm not surprised that a lot of folks all have a drink in the evening. So, you know, this is going to make it a little bit tougher for folks who enjoy doing something like that.
Hmm. Is JAL taking a very aggressive stance on this because they're scared they might get banned by or decertified by different regulatory agencies like ICOA or EASA?
Hmm. Well, I imagine that's a possibility. They also, I think, are sensitive to the negative publicity of this. I mean, if the public perception comes to be that if you fly JAL, you have a high probability of there being an inebriated pilot up front, then that's gonna cause the airline problems. But yeah, I think if that's a good point, Launchpad. If regulatory agencies perceive this to be a particular problem with Japan Airlines, that maybe some repercussions.
Yeah, I think they're doing it because it's the right thing to do, but also they probably realize that they may take a revenue hit over time if people start thinking, well, I've got two choices here. I can fly United or I could fly the airline that has a lot of drunk pilots. I mean, I'm kind of making that an extreme, you know, comparison. But, you know, you look at Southwest when they had the engine failure, you know, they saw revenues dip down, you know, 3 to 4%. So these kinds of things, I think, do have a real impact on, you know, people's decisions when they, you know, when they choose which carrier they're going to fly on.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. Drunk pilot on JAL or United? Yeah, well, that's really a choice decision.
All right, David, which one would you choose?
Don't rush me. I'm thinking. Don't rush me.
I have to be nice. Oh, no, I'm not. My Hawaii trip now is on American, so I don't have to be nice about United.
By the way, just as a comment, I have flown a lot. I have flown every weekend for like the last 7 weeks on a lot of different airlines, and I've had great service from everyone, including United. So
I've actually had great service from United, too, so I don't know. I'm looking forward to flying Hawaii now. That'll be fun.
That will be fun. All right. Well, if you're going to be flying to Hawaii, David, you're going to be going to the airports, of course. And our last item comes from CNET. U.S. airport security is slowly getting just a bit better. Well, at some at airport security checkpoints in the United States, the way they're set up now or have been, as you know, each security station processes passengers serially, right, one at a time. So you wait in line for the person ahead of you before you can proceed in most cases. But now there's a new TSA checkpoint design, and it's rolling out to a number of different airports. It's just come to San Francisco International Airport, and they call them automated security lanes. Except, I mean, they're not really automated. It's kind of I think it's an overly generous title. But what it offers is multiple loading stations. So passengers can load their own bin for the scanner, really at their own pace. There's a series of stations, let's say, where passengers can pull a bin out from underneath, put it up on the belt, and, you know, do their thing, take off their shoes, put their stuff in, open up what needs to be opened up. And if the guy ahead of you takes longer, it doesn't matter because your bin goes on off down the conveyor, and you can proceed right to the scanner yourself. If there is something in your bin that is cause for an additional inspection, then that gets shunted off to another function there, so that doesn't hold up the other people around. And then, of course, you know, you frequently see at these things the security agents who are, you know, carrying armfuls of empty totes back up to the front of the line. Well, in this case, this is kind of automated. There's a secondary kind of conveyor underneath the primary, and the empty bins get delivered to you know, each of the stations automatically. I think there's a reference in here to them being kind of like Pez dispensers, if you know what those are. So not only is this a great idea, I think it seems like, you know, an obvious one is, you know, someone who's come out of manufacturing, out of production. It really is a production problem to process passengers through checkpoints. And I don't know, to me, this makes an awful lot of sense. What do you guys think?
It sounds a lot like Atlanta when I was down there earlier in the summer. Their checkpoint there was you took the bin out, filled it up, sent it down the line, and at the end of it, when you took it out, it went back via conveyor belt to the front of the line. There wasn't any real touching. Now, I, being the moron, had a overly large bottle of shampoo in my luggage, which caused dismay and aggravation as he took it out and threw it out.
Oh, you mean over 3 ounces?
Yes.
Oh, when you said an overly large bottle of shampoo, I just had my, you know, like a gallon jug in my mind for some reason. I'm wondering, what are you going to do with all that shampoo? So, yeah, just more than 3 ounces. Okay. Sorry.
It was not travel size.
All right.
And Atlanta was really challenging to go through checkpoints, just the sheer volume. So anything you can do to speed up the process is a good thing.
And I've read elsewhere that they started rolling these systems out last year, and sure enough, Atlanta is one of the airports that have it. I think that I encountered this in Boston when I was there back in, I want to say, May or something like that. And it had multiple stations where people could get their bins, and then, you know, when they had the bin full, they would push it forward and would go on to the belt. I remember encountering some little problem with it simply because I hadn't seen it before and, you know, didn't do quite the right thing. But I'm sure that as people become familiar with them, it'll get easier and easier. And yes, the bins did come back automatically and would refill. The one thing that I think about when I think about this is complexity and reliability and uptime. And I think they're going to find that these things are going to be a little bit more, well, probably a lot more difficult to maintain and keep up and running. They're just mechanically complex enough that I would expect that they're going to require a fair amount of service. So I've got my fingers crossed that that's not the case, but it's hard to beat something simple like roller bars that they currently have. So this is probably going to be something expensive to maintain and keep up and running.
Hey, Max, you ever heard of something called a conveyor belt, or more to the point, a escalator? They work for hours upon hours upon hours upon hours without any problems. I don't see that this is the same. This is not a new mechanical problem.
Yeah, but it's actually more complex, I think, than the escalators. You know, there you kind of that's analogous to like a tank tread that's moving continuously. Here you just have a lot of different subcomponents. You know, it's not like one continuous belt.
Hmm. Well, according to the article here, I think there's a list of the airports where this has been deployed. It says New York, Los Angeles, Las Vegas, Dallas, Chicago, Minneapolis, Miami, Houston, Newark, Seattle, and Atlanta. And they note that not all of the checkpoints in all of those airports have this new system. So if you travel to one of those airports, depending on where you go through security, I guess you may encounter one of these setups, or you might not. But you know, hopefully these will continue to proliferate. Don't have any reports on the experience, because as you say, Max, I think you know some of these have been out there for a little while, but I don't know if there have been any particular problems associated with them. But you know, if there have been, they all just seem like that would be the kind of thing that could be worked out and perfected and honed and end up being a faster way to process, you know, the cattle through the security checkpoint.
And I agree. I think that, like any system, they'll get better over time. I'm just suggesting, you know, when they first rolls out, that's when you tend to have problems.
So the TSA has a little video, travel tips, automated screening lanes, and we'll put that in the show notes. You'll be able to watch it right on the website, airplanegeeks.com. It's pretty short, and it definitely gives you a visual impression of what the system looks like and how it works.
Hello, I'm Martin Šonka, a 2018 world champion, and you're listening to Airplane Geeks podcast.
Launchpad, you were down in Texas for the Red Bull Air races. We're going to talk about that some coming up, but that was the winner in Texas, wasn't it?
That was Martin Šonka from the Czech Republic, who won the race and thus ended up taking the entire championship. And it actually came down to the final lap or the final heat. It was an exciting time.
Great. All right, we'll talk about that coming up in just a few minutes, actually. But first, what's up with the geeks? Max Trescott, you've probably been doing the most the most lately. What's the news from your trip down under?
Boy, I had a fantastic time. I couldn't have had more fun and met more wonderful people and had a better time. And I commented afterwards, if I ever decided to leave the U.S., I think I'll move to Australia. I just thought the people were fabulous, and wow, it was great. So, by the way, I flew Qantas on their 747, and it was just such a great experience. I was in the premium economy section, which is, you know, three down, if you will, from the most expensive. And it worked out great. I had empty seats next to me both ways. I slept reasonably well in both directions. And from a jet lag standpoint, yeah, I felt a little tired one day when I got there, but that was about it. So it was really pretty easy travel for a 13.5-hour flight. I did fly with four different pilots in their Cirrus aircraft for the Cirrus Pilot Proficiency event that was held there in Orange, New South Wales, about 4 hours drive west of Sydney. And after that, I spent a couple of days in Sydney with friends and just had a great time riding the ferries around the city, looking at all the different sites. Then after that, I drove down 2 hours for 2 days, about 4 hours south toward Pebbly Beach, which is a national park. And I just kind of hung out and recuperated, did a little bit of writing, had a lot of fun. But I got to say, I had invitations from multiple people saying, here, come see me here and I'll take you flying in my helicopter. Come here and I'll take you flying in my pits. Come here and, you know, we'll go out on my boat. Just had so many offers from really kind, wonderful people that it gave me the most possible, you know, favorable impression that you could have. So I only saw just a tiny, tiny, tiny part of the country, but I'm anxious to go back there again sometime. But when I got back here, I found that the San Francisco Bay Area has the worst air quality of anywhere in the world, and it's been that way for over a week now. I've only been back home now about 4 days, but for the week I was gone, we've been running visibilities of 3 miles and less. In fact, at my home airport, visibility has not been better than 2 miles since I got back. It's been running 1.5 to 2 miles, and that's just because of heavy particulate matter from the campfire blowing into our area. Now, the campfire, I haven't measured it, but I'm sure it's more than 100 miles away line of sight. But that's how heavy the smoke is. 100 miles downwind, visibility is just absolutely awful. And I found an interesting resource I'll mention to people. If you go out to purpleair.com, so the color purpleair.com, there's a company which has created some low-cost air quality sensors, and they have put together a map so that people could, you know, put these things in their backyard, hook them up over the internet, and you now have a map of air quality literally around everywhere in the world. And you can see that Northern California is, you know, just deep purple, dark, dark red. I read today that the air quality in San Francisco hit 60 times worse than the recommended level for air particulate matter. And they said it was equivalent to smoking 10 cigarettes a day. That just tells you how bad things are around here. So I literally have been indoors and have just been minimizing my time outdoors to the bare minimum. I've canceled all of my flights because, to me, it's just silly. Why would we be out there, you know, flying in this kind of junk? Rain is forecast to arrive here on Wednesday, and we're hoping that that will help clear out the air. So, I mean, all of this is a minor inconvenience compared to the thousands of people that are homeless as of today. I think they said that over 11,000 homes were burned, destroyed, and at least 76 people from the campfire known to have perished, and hundreds are still missing. So, I mean, this is, they announced the fourth greatest disaster in California to ever occur, and that's after other non-fire events, a couple earthquakes and some other things. So it's quite heart-rending to see what's happened here.
Yeah.
Hey, Max T.
Yeah.
I have almost a homework assignment for you. I'm curious if Cirrus or Lycoming is going to issue an AD or an advisory about checking air filters.
It's a good question. I don't really know, but it makes sense to me.
What's the maintenance interval typically for an air filter like that on an aircraft like that?
Oh, it's a good question. I think on a probably a minimum of 50 hours, probably closer to 100 hours before they change those. But yeah, I mean, I can I can tell you this. I think a lot of those planes are not flying right now. I looked at the schedule, and it looked to me like every single flight was canceled yesterday for all 53 airplanes that we have. I think people are, you know, they realize that, yeah, technically you could fly IFR, but that it's not good for the humans flying it, certainly not good for the airplane. So, yeah. You know, there really are no non-commercial airliners in the sky right now.
Launchpad, you got any other aviation happenings in your life recently?
Yeah, since you last talked to me, I've done the Wings Over Dallas air show. I worked that as a member of the Commemorative Air Force. That was a big Commemorative Air Force end of the year thing. And then just this weekend, I went out and did another Young Eagle rally, which is where we take high school students up flying. That was, you know, give them their first airplane ride and, you know, talk to them about aviation careers.
How many students were involved in that?
This was a very focused group. We did 14 that we brought out of a high school STEM project.
Uh-huh.
So we had not just taking them up to the, you know, for an airplane ride, but we also had the Army brought in a helicopter to, you know, to show them that there, here's a career path. The folks we interviewed, Air Evac Rescue Life Team brought in one of their air medevac helicopters. Hmm. We had the local FAA controller come in from the tower. We had flight instructors and mechanic instructors and a couple of contract pilots and a dispatcher, all to talk about different careers in aviation, not just flying airplanes.
Wow. And how long, what was the length of this this program?
It was basically 2 hours. We let the students, we divided them in half, and half went out flying while half talked to the instructors, and then we swapped the groups. And normally during a Young Eagles flight, we do about 20, 25 minutes in the air. This one was much more in-depth because they're a much more focused target audience. So we were doing closer to 45-minute flights plus 15 minutes of post-flight recovery with the students.
And did you say already what the age group was?
This was high school students, so we were doing 14 through 18 year olds.
Yeah, and what was the reaction? What did they think after this experience?
It was very positive. I flew one young lady who I don't have permission to say her name on the air, who really got it, and it was exciting. She, you know, after about 5 minutes of instruction, she was like, "Well, this is pretty easy," and I was like, "Well, yeah, but don't tell your friends that, because, you know, let's keep it mysterious." But, you know, and we were able to deviate. There was a grass fire. She goes, and I was like, "Okay, fly us over. We'll do a lap around the top of a grass fire." And, you know, we orbited a grass fire. She did, you know, didn't lose any altitude. And, you know, she was like, "Well, I can do this." And I was like, "Yes, you can."
Hmm. This is an amazing program, I think. From everything I've ever seen, it's just a great way to generate some enthusiasm in young folks for aviation.
Right. And our target was all aspects. It wasn't just getting your pilot's license. It was the other parts of aviation. We had a flight surgeon there, talked about, you know, aeromedical. It was pretty good. And then yesterday I went to this Red Bull. Oh, yeah, we mentioned that, the Red Bulls.
That's right. This was the championship finale in Fort Worth.
It was. And before we say another thing, I want to thank the Red Bull organization for inviting me up to help cover it. And to our listeners out there, if you get a chance to do a Red Bull event, and especially a Red Bull Air Races, I cannot say go strong enough. As pre-mentioned, they really make the on-track experience for the viewer, the guest, is phenomenal. And it's on par, if not better, than what we get at Formula One. The professionalism is there. There's always something to look at. There's other things going on at the track. It was, and your situational awareness of what the aircraft are doing, who's in the aircraft, where they are in the standing, was easily absorbed.
Interesting. Now, maybe for all of us, describe the venue where this took place.
This took place at the Texas Motor Speedway. It's actually a NASCAR oval. And what they do that also is really cool, they build a runway in the middle of the oval. And then they put up the air gates. You've seen them. They have an entry gate, a series of slaloms, single gates, and then a double gate. And it's really exciting because you can watch the planes taxi out from their hangars. They build temporary hangars, and then you can watch them take off. They make the call, smoke on, and you'll see the airplanes come in. They're describing what he's doing. There's a running commentary. There's times that are being shown live. It's very exciting. And what you get is one plane comes through the slalom and leaves, and it's a timed event. So there's only one plane on the track at a time. But the altitudes are extremely low, but it's extremely safe. And it's very exciting.
All right. Well, we've got a recording that you provided to us, and it's really in two parts, isn't there? The first is the press event.
Yeah, I got to attend the actual debriefing and press event and got to ask a question. And then representing the podcast among, you know, I was next to ESPN2 and the Dallas paper. And then I was able to get an exclusive with Mike Gullion.
All right. Well, let's listen to this right now.
Sir, it's over to you.
Hi, gentlemen. Brad Marzari from the Airplane Geeks podcast. As a random, I'll just ask this of Michael Gullion. My electronic flight bag shows that with the current temperature, barometric, and altitude, density altitude is 1, which makes this the lowest, or if you will, the thickest air that the Red Bull racers have ever had to race through. Can you please explain what you had to do to get adjusted to flying through this thick air?
That's actually it's a great question. And my tactician and I, Pablo, were talking before I left about, hey, don't over-G. Because when the air is thick like it is here, the elevator works really well. So you just have to be a little careful, and for me, it's just a way that I actually apply the G to the stick, changes with the temperature and the speed of the airplane. So, but actually, in the round of 14, coming out of gate 7, I pulled about 11.9.5 G right up at the end, and so it was, we were trying to get around that corner, and you know, it's just one of those things where you have to know your airplane really well. And it's a game. Everybody here played that game today. It's a new day. The wind condition is from the other direction. It's really cold outside. The engine's making a lot of power, and the airplane's really powerful. So you have to back off a little bit, but not so much that you go from your normal profile to a lot less G, right? It's easy to go from 11 and something down to 9 and something, and that's a second on the racetrack. So it's just one of those balancing things, and that's why all of us know our planes so well that you can make that adjustment, or at least you try to.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Any more questions for the gentleman on the stage?
Hello, airplane geeks. I'm here with our favorite at Red Bull racer, Mr. 99, Mike Gullion.
How are you doing today?
We're doing great.
Great.
Hey, how's it feel to take a third? I mean,
you know, it's awesome. I'm a little disappointed. Obviously, we didn't finish the job here in Fort Worth, but the season was awesome. We were so consistent. Our team was awesome. The airplane performed really well. And we just have such great hopes now going into 2019 because we have confidence as a team that we can go and do it week in and week out.
Any changes, major changes for next year? Engine, airframe, avionics?
So right now the changes to the airplane will stay until the next year because the airplane that actually goes on a boat to Abu Dhabi on Wednesday. So we made all of our upgrades here before this race, actually. So we'll make some electronic changes to the airplane, which we'll implement in Abu Dhabi. And then we'll just work on our team strategy because we have a pretty great airplane already.
Okay, we discussed earlier during the press conference the G's. Do you have an active G meter in the aircraft that you're looking at, or are you just doing it by feel?
So in the Red Bull Air Race, what they call the onset of the G, the rate at which the G comes on, if I'm working at my best, it's almost 90 degrees a second. So the human eye, you can't follow it that fast. So you can't look at a G meter. It's all a matter of muscle memory, but we do have. So I have an electronic G meter, and I also have an analog G meter, the old fashioned kind. that sits right next to the panel, and I can see it out of the corner of my eye, but we also have an oral tone in our headset. So when I go over 10G, I get a tone in my headset, and I can only be over 10G for 0.6 seconds. So what I do is pull up very aggressively, hear the beep come on. I try to hold it for about 0.2, let off to get underneath 10, and then get back on the G. So we do what you would call a double pull, all within about a half a second. And that's how you get the airplane turned around very quickly. So the goal is really to get to about 11.5G for 5/10, back under 10, back up to 11.5, and back under 10, all in about a half a second. And that's how we do that. But it's all feel.
Okay, now, with the airfield being located right here on the event, which was really great for us spectators,
yeah.
What about onboard fuel? How much are you getting to carry? A little less?
No, but by the regulations, you have to carry 50 liters. So everybody carries the minimum amount of fuel. It's 50 liters. So unfortunately, you can't play any games with fuel because it's a certain number. And everybody, you get tested before you get onto the track. You roll onto the scales in the technical hangar. They look at the amount of oil you have, the amount of fuel you have, what the airplane weighs, what the pilot weighs. And then after you get back from the race, you get back on the scale to make sure the pilot is within the same weight.
Okay, I was thinking maybe you could get away with like, okay, we only need about 2 gallons for this.
Yeah, that would be nice, I wish. They've thought of everything.
You talked about your fuel injection problem that you've been working with Lycoming on. If the airplane's getting packed up this week, how much time do you got to rip an engine apart?
We don't have any, actually. So we'll work with Lycoming to try to analyze where it's coming from, what it's doing. So when we go to Abu Dhabi, the first thing we'll do is we'll put the airplane together and then attack that issue and see what it really is, because we're not exactly sure yet.
Well, sir, I want to thank you for taking the time. Congratulations on podium at the end of the season. And if they want to know more about Mike Gullion, where would they go?
Well, so you can go to MikeGullion.com, and then we have a really great Instagram page and also a great Facebook page that we're putting great photos and images and behind-the-scenes stuff there. So,
well, thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Listeners, this is your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari, frequency change approved. Good day.
All right. It sounds like a fantastic time.
Oh, it was. And the Red Bull organization could not have been nicer to us. And I want to emphasize how, you know, taking a podium or taking a third or getting on the podium at the end of the season was a major accomplishment, not something to sneeze at. He's been working at this a long time, and it's a really tough competition.
Yeah. And I understand Matt Hall did pretty well from Australia. We used to hear interviews with him from Plane Crazy Down Under.
He took second overall, and then, of course, Mashanka from Czech Republic took first. But, yes, Matt Hall was number two on the podium.
Fantastic.
It was a really good day. It was, as you heard, cold, so it was some really thick flying, and the planes were just whipping it around and that stuff. Max T, when's the last time you went? You should try pulling 10 Gs.
Well, I don't know about 10, but I'm good for 1.5.
I think the most I ever experienced in an airplane was, I think, around 3 in a glider, in an aerobatic glider. That seemed like an awful lot to me at the time. So 10 or 11 sounds like, wow, that's just something else.
I've gotten to do 4 in a centrifuge, and you're laying on your back. Literally, it was almost like being in one of the circus rides. And they said, do a sit-up, and you, like, barely can put your chin on your, your breastbone. You're like, 1.
Yeah.
Again, it's going to start up again next year. It's an exciting time. It's really fun for aviation. And we've got some future reports coming. We got an exclusive with the director of the Red Bull Air Races, and we'll have that ready for a future show.
Terrific. Thanks again for doing that. All right, let's do a little bit of listener mail. We've been asking folks for some suggestions for their favorite YouTube channels that are aviation related. And we heard from our friend Jonathan Barron in the Slack team. He points us to, this is a channel from Mike called Mojo Grip. And Jonathan notes that Mike tends to cater to the younger, newer to aviation crowd, which is great. And in the description for MotoGrip, Mike says he's a serial entrepreneur. He shares his passion for business and aviation. He says in the videos you'll find they're dedicated to airplanes, motorcycles, and self-growth. And he's a recent pilot himself. He says he passed his private pilot's exam December 2016. And it was through his training process that he started this channel. He notes that becoming a pilot was one of the most challenging and fulfilling things I've done, he says. All the sweat and frustration mixed with fun were worth it. Now I get to share this awesome passion with you. So we'll have a link to Mojo Grip, that YouTube channel, in the show notes. And we also heard from John, who says he has a little YouTube page that he's been slowly working on. These are of flights he's conducted out in Western Canada. And he says he's a medevac captain. He's been doing that for the past 12 years. He loves the flying out there. He says he listens to the podcast when he's not flying. He manages the base of pilots there. He develops standards. He's also a Czech pilot. And so that is, so his initials are JG, and the name of the channel is QUAZIJG. How would you guys pronounce that? I know what I would call it.
We'll go right ahead.
No, you guys.
Yeah. I would call it the link at the bottom of the page.
No. So I figure that's Quasi. Quasi JG. Like you know, the Quasi Wabbit.
Or Quasi, maybe.
It could be Quasi.
Quasimodo.
No, I like Quasi, as in Wascally Wabbit.
Exactly. That's what I'm thinking. So anyway, we'll have a link to that in the show notes also. We also heard from Denver, and this is on David made some comment about going through immigration and customs to enter the U.S., and this was about visitors who are being allowed in some airports and in some cases to go through security even though they don't have tickets and meet the arriving passengers or just to partake in the activities of the airport on the other side of security. And David had an interesting suggestion, which was, if you're going to limit access, if you're going to limit access, why not give it to folks who are meeting returning service people to the U.S. And Denver points out that that might be tough because these people are usually coming in through international gates, which are not part of this program. So I guess that makes sense, David.
I got a thing on that, though. The reason, on David's behalf, everybody who's meeting their returning service member would have a dependent's ID card. So therefore, you could easily identify who they are. And there's another level of security or a step up because they would have an ID card.
Hmm. Yeah, that would identify them. Yeah. But I think this program is limited to domestic gates right now, so that's somewhat limiting. But I still think David's thinking is great. If there was a way to do it, that would be kind of nice.
And I did respond back. One of the things that didn't cross my mind about international flights and going through customs and stuff is most of my international flying involves me going to see my family in Toronto. And I forgot that it's an oddball thing that I go through U.S. Customs in Toronto at YYZ before coming home. So when I get off the airplane in Philadelphia, I don't go through customs. I've been through customs in Canada.
Yeah.
So customs didn't even cross my mind because, I do so much more flying domestically. And the international flying I do, I don't really have a customs portion to go through unless I'm in Canada both ways. So, but I still think there's a way to figure this out for everybody.
Yeah.
Hey, speaking of customs, since I just came through a couple of days ago, there is a new app available for smartphones called Mobile Passport, which is put out by the U.S. government. And I loaded this just before I left the country. And the one limitation on it is when you're coming back into the country, you can't activate it. You can't, you know, trigger the arrival more than 4 hours in advance of your arrival. So you would think, oh, well, gosh, most international flights are more than 4 hours. What good is that? I went ahead while I was, right after we landed, I went ahead and, you know, filled in the information. And before I'd actually stepped off the airplane, I'd already, you know, triggered it. So it is indeed very, very useful, even if you are on a really long flight. But I was surprised when I went into San Francisco for customs, I was directed to the line which had one person waiting in it. And I assure you, that was much shorter than any other line there. So I highly recommend, if you're going to be traveling internationally, get a Mobile Passport app, and it will probably save you a heck of a lot of time coming back into the country.
Yeah, I'm looking at this now. The website is mobilepassport.us. It says, breeze through customs. App speeds you through U.S. Customs and Border Protection at 3 cruise ports and 26 airports. App is fully or officially authorized by U.S. Customs and Border Protection. So what is the – oh, here's a map of the airports. How does this work? What is how does this speed you through?
Yeah, sure. So when you first set up the app, the first time you log in, it wants you to either fill in a whole ton of information or to simply scan your passport. Well, I started to type it in and thought, heck with this, and just use my iPad to you know, take a camera shot, if you will, of my passport. Boom. It correctly copied in, you know, probably 6-7 different things from my passport. And then from there, when you enter the country, all you really need to tell it is what country you're coming from, what flight you're coming from, and then you end up checking off 5 different boxes, which are kind of the normal things you'd expect. Are you bringing any food back with you? Have you been in contact with any livestock where you're overseas? Have you bringing in, you know, more than $10,000 worth of cash? Things like that. And then you just go ahead and submit it. And it then starts the 4-hour clock. And when you show up at the line, you can't show them a screenshot of it. You have to actually show them the open app, because for that 4 hours, there's going to be a crawl which goes across the screen, and that tells the customs agent that, okay, this indeed is not a screenshot, and it's been activated within the past 4 hours. And there is a QR code that shows up on it, and they just scan that with their scanner, and boom, you're done. You know, the entire process once you show up is, you know, probably 45 seconds longer for me, because there was another customs agent being trained as I was standing there, which is how I got to find out, you know, more of the details of it.
It says on the website that this information that you set up in your profile is encrypted and shared only with CBP. So that's good. That would be, a deal breaker if that wasn't the case. This looks very interesting. I think I'm going to take a look at this. So again, that's mobilepassport.us. Very interesting.
Sure. And then the other tip, of course, would be to get either TSA pre- or global entry. And I did TSA pre back in March. It's good for 5 years. You pay $85 and it gets you in the short line as you fly domestically. And not at all airports, but many of the larger airports. And that line is always shorter than the normal TSA line. I got to tell you, that's the best $85 I think I've spent in a long time.
Great.
I'll be flying to Europe for Christmas, so I'll give your passport thing a second beta test. I'm excited about it.
Yeah, great. And let us know your impressions. All right, let's wrap this one up. Thanks for listening, everyone. Again, we're going to start to return to our usual format with a guest next week. As always, you can find us at airplanegeeks.com. There's show notes there for every episode. You can listen to episodes there, but we really encourage you to subscribe to the podcast. There are a variety of different apps that you can use on your smartphones, on your mobile devices, your tablets, both for iOS and Android. If you'd like to send us an email, we're at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And this being episode 528, if you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, that's airplanegeeks.com/528. All right, Max Trescott, where do folks find you online?
Well, I'm so happy that they can find me back in the United States. It's always fun to be home. Mm-hmm. The usual places, go to aviationnewstalk.com. You can click on contact there, or you can click on listener question if you want to ask something on the show. And, of course, look for Aviation News Talk anywhere where you find podcasts.
Cool. And David Vanderhoof, how about you?
You can find me on Twitter, if you can spell DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on Facebook. You can be part of our Slack listener team. We want you to join there. You can send that to your request to the geeks at airplanegeeks.com and join that conversation. And, of course, you can hear me not necessarily on this Friday, but a week from Friday with that guy, Max Flight, because we're taking off Thanksgiving. So that takes care of that.
All right. And Launchpad Marzari, if we want to find out how to get in touch with you or see you online, where do we do that?
The best place is Facebook, where I'm Launchpad Marzari. I'm also trying to not be a big a slacker, or am I am being a slacker, when I hang out on the Slack page. And I'm Twitter, but I don't do very well at Twitter, at Pilot Launchpad.
All right, great, great. And you can find me sometimes on Twitter at Max Flight. You can look for me in LinkedIn, as David said, over at the UAVDigest.com, talking about unmanned aircraft and systems, and over at PAXX Podcast with Mary Kirby, talking about the passenger experience. Our outro is by Bruno Massone. You can find more of his compositions where he incorporates aviation sounds into other music. You find that at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Frequency change approved.
And thanks for listening.
Hey, before everybody hangs up, I got something cool to tell you.
Yeah? Is it really cool?
I think it is for me.
All right.
I want to share it with you.
How cool is it?
If you remember back, and I'm going to put it on the Slack page, but I got to do the homework.
Okay.
I did a report about AirLife EVAC and their support of World Endurance and Formula One down at the
yes.
This is the same company that we invited to do the Young Eat. We invited to come out to Young Eagles to, you know, to show a profession in aviation.
Mm-hmm.
And the chief pilot came out and he looked at me and he went, "Oh yes." And he goes, "I've been told to give you this. And I have a Life EVAC challenge coin for the work we did at, in our report."
So nice.
I'm going to photograph it and put it on the Slack. Yeah. They coined
do that
for, the work for our report of the other one. So I'm like, haha! How cool is that for the amateur guy?
That is great. I have this dream of creating an Airplane Geeks challenge coin, and I actually started to look into it. There are several companies that produce.
I've designed several of these.
Yeah, they're kind of expensive. I don't remember the per coin price, but it's
I was guessing they are. Anything that's heavy is expensive.
Yeah.
You're about $2 to $3 a coin now.
Yeah, minimum.
And having actually done this, the problem is it's setting up the die.
Yes, there's a fixed.
Is a fixed, you know,
fixed
$300, $400 charge.
Right.
Whoa,
set
baby.
The die.
Yes.
Wow.
And then.
But we make it up in volume.
Well, yeah. See, and long story made very short, when we were doing this before, flag officers in certain commands are authorized. And they can do the die, and they can run up to, usually it's a minimum of 50 coins. And they do that.
and they have a budget they're allowed to do that with. And what's really funny is those coins can only be given to members of their own command, as you know, they can't print them out. But in the rules, they can order a second set of coins out of their own pocket. And they can do anything they want with those.
Using that same die?
Yes, you don't have to reimburse the government for the die. And so you always end up placing two orders with the company, one for the die and the minimum coin run, which is 50, and then a second run of like 400 coins. And the companies know the rules, and they'll send it to you. Here's your first 50, and the aide has to keep those separate because you have to actually record who you give them to. But the other 400, you can just frisbee them out whoever you want. But yeah, depending on what you do with the coin, because you can do all sorts of elaborate things with the coins. They can get as high as $4 or $5 a coin.
Oh, yeah. And when I look into it, that's kind of the numbers I was looking at. When you take the die charge, plus if you figure, I forget, you know, like 100 coins, the per coin charge or cost, rather, for, you know, both of those, the die and the... and the charge per coin, you can get up around $5, and it really does add up fast. But
right, and some of the units have done some cool stuff to try and get around that. A couple of fighter units are actually using, they had custom made poker chips because the cost of the poker chip is way down. But you know,
so it's like a plastic. Yeah.
It's made out of the same thing as poker chips.
Yeah.
The other one was. The Special Forces group in Africa, they had theirs made out of wood.
Oh.
Which is kind of unique for them because it was like, you know, hey, yeah, all their coins are wooden. And it was like, oh, that's kind of cool. Yeah, you know, it was so different. It was cool.
Yeah, yeah.
And then a lot of folks I've also seen are using the die is different. It's like a bottle opener.
And oh, so yeah.
They're giving out these flat bottle openers.
Yeah, yeah.
And but they're not as cool as a challenge coin. But they're, you know, in ways to try and be unique and keep the cost under control.
I'd still like to do it somehow someday. So I wonder if we know anybody that's got, you know, graphic design skills or something that
I've done this before. I'll take a shot at it.
Yeah. Are you any good?
Oh, I've got 3 or 4 coins under my belt.
Or are you just a hack?
That I've signed.
Really?
Normally you do it with...
Hey, let's not insult him, okay?
Yeah. Normally you do... Yeah, don't do it in PowerPoint. You do it in a Photoshop, but I actually use Canvas. It's a engineering drawing program.
Yeah, I know Canvas.
Yeah, I did them all in Canvas, and then...
Does that do vector graphics?
Hey, yes. Can you make me a Bitcoin? That's what I want to know.
Yeah.
Hey, there you go. We could have a challenge Bitcoin.
That would be quite a challenge, I think.
Pass them out. They're worth like a nickel.
$10,000.
Well, maybe, we could have a contest, you know. I mean, if we had at least a couple of people that are so inclined and skilled and could, you know, sketch up a design... if we had more than a couple of those, we could put them out there and say, you know, which have the listeners vote on them or something, and then find some way to.
Okay, because normally though, that is a possibility. I was going to say though, Max.
Yeah.
One of the things is that it's always a reflection of. I'm talking from my past. It's always been a reflection of the commander's attitude, of what the coin looks like.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You being the executive producer here, you get final vote of like, oh, but I want to have a flower on it or whatever.
Have we just promoted him to flag officer? Is that what you're telling me?
I think so.
No, I didn't want to.
So this would be the Airplane Geeks Challenge Coin Challenge.
Oh, cute.
Cute, yes.
That's good.
Why don't you just make it the Airplane Geeks Coin Challenge?
Because I think the challenge coin challenge is a little more
play is fun.
Whimsical. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, there's an idea. Let's see.
Let's kick that around.
We'll kick that around.
Let's get the server running up first.
That's right. This is the week that airplanegeeks.com is supposed to move. to a different server. And so if it works,
that'll show Mark for having left the show.
No, Rob's been really good. He's
I know.
He's helping us do this. So, all right. I think that's it.